Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a deadly inferno and aftermath in Oakland. The president-elect's tweets and space legend John Glenn has died. 36 people dead after a blaze ripped through an Oakland warehouse and artist colony. Alameda County Sheriff spokesman Sergeant Ray Kelly described the terrible aftermath.
We found a lot of victims in the wreckage here that were holding each other and caring for each other as they waited to die.
Donald Trump went after Boeing on what he called a $4 billion deal to build the next Air Force One.
I think it's ridiculous. I think Boeing is doing a little bit of a number. We want Boeing to make a lot of money, but not that much money.
And astronaut John Glenn, the first American to orbit Earth, dead at 95. Here he is on that most famous mission, 1962.
Zero G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around.
Zero G and I feel fine. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Audrey Cooper, Janet Hook, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is Trump on course to make the changes to the country that you expected? Will his cabinet picks improve or undo the work of the Obama administration? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Audrey Cooper, editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle. Audrey, thanks for joining us again. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
And joining us from Washington, Janet Hook, national political correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Janet, welcome back. Great to have you as well.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Audrey, and Janet.
Audrey, can we come first to you? You're right there next to Oakland, and we want to know the latest that's going on. Is somebody likely to go to jail in the aftermath of this terrible conflagration at the Artist Colony warehouse in Oakland, Audrey?
Well, nobody has been arrested yet, but to be honest with you, I don't see how that can't happen. There are so many laws being violated in this warehouse before the fire ignited that, and there's so many people who knew about it. And at the very least, you have to think that the city of Oakland is looking at some civil suits for their utter failure to ever do anything to inspect this building.
The city itself, because they just didn't keep track of what was going on, but it was well known. How do you account for what happened there, Audrey?
Well, you know, there's a lot going on here in Oakland. The first thing that everybody has to understand is housing prices are insane in the Bay Area. Mm. And Oakland is literally right across the bay from San Francisco, which is the most expensive place to – I can attest this personally – one of the most expensive places to live. And, you know, if you're an artist and you're making – you're living through your art – it's expensive to find a place that you can afford. And so these warehouses, these artist collectives are a part of Oakland. They're a part of the Bay Area, and they have been for decades. What happened here, though, is that the city is supposed to have both fire inspectors and building inspectors go out and look at all of their buildings. It's required by state law. And they're admitting in the first hours after the conflagration started that that wasn't happening here.
A little sound of that. This was Joel Shanahan. He was DJing in the warehouse the night of the fire. This was last Friday, and the aftermath has just rolled on in Oakland. He told NBC he had stepped out for a cigarette just before the blaze began.
It was hell. We just had to watch the exit for hours and just wait. And they never came out.
And here's the Alameda County District Attorney, Nancy O'Malley, saying this week that a number of charges, criminal charges, are possible in connection with that warehouse fire.
The range of charges could be murder all the way to involuntary manslaughter. And until we know what the evidence shows us, there may be other charges if the evidence presents that.
Here's the founder and manager of the Artist Collective housed inside that warehouse. It was known as the Ghost Ship. He was asked, this is Derek Almena, he was asked by NBC's Today Show if he should be held accountable for the fire.
Am I the man who should be held accountable? Did I build something that, what am I going to say to that? Should I be held accountable? I can barely stand here right now.
Audrey Cooper is editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle, just across the bay. I mean, you say housing prices are part of what's driving this. Is it possible the city turned a blind eye because they were just sympathetic to the circumstances of people who cannot afford otherwise, could not, to live in Oakland?
Well, there's no doubt of that. The city of Oakland is interested in fostering this sort of artistic freedom and artistic communities. It's, you know, you can call it a hipster haven if you're being derisive, perhaps. But it's really something that Oakland and Oaklanders take a lot of pride in, that they're able to foster this artistic community. There's a fine line, however, between that and what happened here, which is something that was literally a death trap. And in fact, the Chronicle, we went out to other warehouses. These are pretty frequent things in Oakland and across the Bay Area. And we went to one and it is literally called, they call themselves the death trap.
Wow.
So, welcome, you know, there's a lot more crackdowns that I think are inevitable here.
We've got to get to Donald Trump and his moves, but we have callers for you, Audrey, in San Francisco. Nathan in Des Moines, Iowa, you're on the air with San Francisco. Hi, Nathan.
Hello. I wanted to, I live in Des Moines, Iowa, as you said, which actually has some of the lowest rent in America. And yet, even here, I feel like the income inequality and the lack of career mobility and lack of housing options for young people is a major crisis. I think it's everywhere in this country that young people do not have the opportunities in their lives to gain traditional housing, the kind of income to support, you know, buying a house or even getting an apartment that's safe. And I feel frustrated that this keeps being described as this San Francisco problem, this Oakland problem. It's a Des Moines, Iowa problem. It's a Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania problem. I think it's a problem everywhere that young people do not have the career options and don't have the income access to afford them a safe place to live.
Nathan, I appreciate your call. I mean, let's pull the curtain back here. Janet, we're going to Trump, but you know, the image raised here is of a country where young people don't have the economic standing to make their way into the economy in a traditional way, to find a foothold in the housing market and get going. Now, as Audrey Cooper points out, San Francisco, Oakland are extreme examples of this. But the first call from Iowa says, hey, this is a problem all over.
Yeah, and it's not clear what Trump would do as president to address this. I mean, he just made his appointment to the cabinet of Ben Carson to be the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And he's not a man with a lot of experience either with running an agency or with housing programs. So that's not a very hopeful sign. It's a very interesting point that the caller raises, though, about this as a problem of income inequality and of that particularly affects younger people, because that was supposed to be a big focus of the 2016 presidential campaign. Income inequality and the votes of the millennials were supposed to stampede towards the Democrats, and it's just not clear that the results of the election are, you know, send any clear message about what a Trump administration is going to do for that.
I mean, Donald Trump was very clear on the stump that he was going to stand up for the little guy who was forgotten in the era of globalization and income inequality. We've got a lot of cabinet picks now on the table. What do you see in those, Janet, about the direction of this administration? We've got labor. Let's start right there. That's where people make their money. And a fast food baron kind of in charge there now, out of Hardee's and Carl's Jr., a huge franchiser of those outlets. What do you see in the labor secretary pick front?
Well, I see it in the labor secretary pick what you see in a lot of his choices, which is a cabinet member who's coming to dismantle the legacy of the Obama years. He has been a critic of some of the regulations that have been promulgated by President Obama's Labor Department, like the overtime rules. He's opposed to a big national minimum wage increase. And, you know, for all Donald Trump saying that he's an advocate for the little guy, he's picked a lot of billionaires for his cabinet. And Andy Pusner is just the latest.
He's also seems to be a proponent of automation. Now, we know that's coming. That's just the way of technology here. But He's talked with Business Insider this year and told them that automation would be welcomed because machines, quoting him here, are always polite, they always upsell, they never take a vacation, they never show up late, there's never a slip and fall or an age, sex, or race discrimination case. Labor Secretary there, Jack Beatty, kind of cheerleading for the coming automation of labor.
Yes, and in his sort of anti-labor pitch, he's of a piece with the theme of the Trump cabinet. You know, Herbert Hoover promised a chicken in every pot. Trump's cabinet choices, as a letter writer to the Times points out, promises a fox in every hen house. You've got the labor secretary, who's spoken against human labor. Robots are better. You've got an education secretary who's against public education. You've got an Environmental Protection Agency head who's against protecting the environment, and a Secretary of Housing and Urban Development who's against integrated public housing. Luckily, the Secretary of Defense is for defense.
Audrey, as you look at the cabinet begin to roll out, your thoughts from the West Coast watching on there?
You know, what I've found to be really interesting is the steady stream of would-be secretaries and other people interested going to Trump Tower for their 45-minute meetings, and then the media having these grand pronouncements about what these means. I don't know about you, but I can't get anything done in a 45-minute meeting of any consequence. So, I mean, for me, I think we just have to wait and see what they're actually intending to do and what's going to be the top of the priority list.
But we've got a lot on the table here now. I mean, between Ben Carson, Linda McMahon for the Small Business Administration, of course, she was the founder of the World Wrestling Federation, is that what it is? Terry Branstad now headed off to China as ambassador. You've got Doug Pruitt for the EPA, big tie out of Oklahoma, big ties to the fossil fuel industry. Says he wants to bring power back to the states. But of course, Audrey, that means to energy-producing states where they would let that fossil fuel energy roll.
Yeah, well, I think there's some people in California, at least, that cheered at that idea because there's a lot of fear that drilling off the California coast would get ramped up. I mean, I think if you really mean that you're going to go with the states' rights argument, there are a lot of places, including very blue states, that are going to be really down with that. The question is whether that means the interests of the red states being forced upon the blue states.
That's interesting. California might take it and run just the other way. No offshore drilling, please. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. More Donald Trump cabinet picks. More Trump tweets. Inferno in Oakland. A mistrial in North Charleston. South Korean impeachment. And John Glenn has died. Janet Hook is with us, national political reporter at the Wall Street Journal, joining us from Washington. From San Francisco, Audrey Cooper is here, editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. What do you see in the emerging Trump cabinet? A fast food chief for labor secretary, a climate change denier to head the EPA, the world wrestling chief for small business. Is this the cabinet you voted for, the one you feared? Are we going to have a tweeting president all the way through? And if we do, where does that go? Kellyanne Conway, senior Trump advisor out this week in an interview with CNBC, saying that critics of the president-elect are just afraid he will succeed.
Look, they are so afraid he can actually succeed. And if Donald Trump succeeds and makes good on all of his promises as president in the first 100 days, you have a roaring economy again. And the answers were there at all times. It just takes will and it takes leadership. And, you know, now that he has the Congress across the hill here, guys, yep, there's really no excuse to not get it done.
So stand back. Here we go. Dan in Savannah, Georgia. Dan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to comment on the labor secretary. He was touting automation, and I honestly don't see that as a bad thing. I think that automation is coming, whether we like it or not, and we need to start having a conversation about a universal basic income. I think it's inevitable, and machines can do our jobs so much faster than us, more efficient, and there are going to be so many people out of work, the government is going to need to pay people to not work. I think automation is here whether we like it or not, and we need to start talking about it.
Dan, I think you're exactly right on that. I mean, it's growing and growing, but of course, Janet Hook, the promise was to bring jobs back to coal mining areas and to steel factories and more. And it's not just the labor secretary's
Andrew Puzder's acknowledgement that automation is coming, but the way he describes the machines as better than humans. They never take a vacation. They never show up late. They never slip or fall. Can Donald Trump, Janet, bring those jobs back if we're headed to automation? And what about the attitude implicit in the Labor Secretary's embrace of machines over we mere fallible humans?
Well, I think that that comment that you quoted that Puzder made was sort of a classic that illustrates ways in which he's kind of like Trump, which is that, yes, automation is kind of an inevitable part of our economy.
Yep.
But the way he expressed it was kind of blunt and rude, you know. It also gets to what Kellyanne Conway was talking about, you know, that people are fearing that he's successful in it. I don't think people are fearful that he's going to be successful so much as there's a question about his promises were so broad and bold. The idea of bringing these jobs back into the American economy. I mean, the coal jobs that he's talking about, yes, they're not only threatened by mechanization and broader forces than any president can control. It feels like sometimes he was going and talking to steel towns and coal towns and talking about the economy of yesterday. And one thing that's clear is that he may improve the economy, but it will not be like yesterday's economy.
We're not going there. Universal basic income. Do you see Congress, the Trump administration, somebody trying to figure out what to do if machines do take the jobs, Janet?
Well, you know, universal minimum income, I don't think that's something that a Republican Congress would consider. I do think that his critique of the impact of trade raises broader questions about what can be done for workers who are displaced by an array of forces, globalization as well as mechanization. I don't think he's very clear on what the solutions that he would bring.
Amy in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Amy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. So just in regard to Kellyanne Conway's suggestion that, you know, he might just make good on his promises.
Yeah.
You know, my concern around the economy is that, you know, we really need to be able to have living wages for people and or, you know, really robust training for handling automation and so that people can work in an automated environment. And that if the other issue around his making good for taking care of people around the EPA and the concern that around climate change, that the group Mothers Out Front for Climate Change, which seems like a very promising name in itself, that perhaps that invitation could be extended to Chelsea Clinton to join and express leadership there, and that she might in turn extend an invitation to...
You're losing me, Amy. You're just losing me. I mean, I'm all for it, but I'm not sure where you're going there. I appreciate your call. I want to look at Donald Trump and his tweets this week. They get right into business in a couple of ways, on a labor angle and on a huge business angle. He went after Boeing in a tweet, saying they had put forth a $4 billion proposal for an Air Force One program to replace those planes, a couple of them, which they always have at the ready. We heard him in the lobby of Trump Tower talking about it, and then he talked with Matt Lauer about his tweet and the criticism there. He said the company, Boeing, needs to do better in setting the price for new presidential planes.
Well, I think the planes are too expensive. I spoke to a very good man yesterday, the head of Boeing, terrific guy, and we're going to work it out. But, you know, that's what I'm here for. I'm going to negotiate prices, and the planes are too expensive, and we're going to get the prices down. And if we don't get the prices down, we're not going to order them. We're going to stay with what we have.
Audrey Cooper, you're watching this from the California there, and I just wonder how you're thinking about the president jawboning a major American corporation to bring those prices down. Is this good management? After all, these are his planes. We all know that he's got his own jet. He knows something about the cost of jets. These are not like ordinary jets, but $4 billion is a lot of money. Is this the president watching the national pocketbook in a responsible way, or does this get too deeply into... you know, the work of an individual corporation and contracts it's worked out with the federal government.
Right. Well, you know, what's that old saying, a billion here, a billion there, and all of a sudden you're talking about real money.
$4 billion is real money, yeah.
Yeah, it's real money. You know, he's playing into exactly what the people who voted for him wanted him to do, which is stop spending what is perceived as, you know, this out-of-control government that doesn't think about how much money that actually is. However, you know, I think, you know, those of us in the media, we're really careful about what we put out there. We know the impact of words and opinion have on the public and, more importantly, have on the markets. When he tweeted that out, the value of Boeing dropped. This man
has
so
what? He's not responsible to Boeing. He's responsible to the citizens of the United States if they're spending too much for the planes.
I don't think on one hand you can say that you care a lot about workers and then on the other cavalierly cause the company share price to drop.
Okay.
You know, the economy is a complicated thing. I know people don't want to think that all the time, but it is. And, you know, there are ways to do that without putting it out in 140 characters.
Going to Bill in LaGrange, Texas. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm pleased with the cabinet and I'm pleased with what Trump's doing. I voted for Trump. So we would have a change. I think a lot of what Obama's put in needs to come out. I think he's a businessman, and what he does will be good for our country. What I do see is a lot of the pundits on the East Coast and the West Coast, the places that voted for Hillary, giving him a hard time. I say, hey, step back and let's see what happens. I mean, look, he's already taken care of the carrier thing.
Kind of. I mean, we'll look at that. You got the Indiana Union boss complaining about that. But you just hear Audrey Cooper right here, Bill, saying basically the same as you, that Trump voters want change. When you look at the cabinet picks, do you see emerging what you voted for, Bill?
That's exactly right. We're the part of the country between the East Coast and West Coast that the people who voted for Hillary fly over and don't realize is here. We're the people that put the food on the table. We're the people that do the work.
Well, we've got a lot of people all over this country and people on the coast who spend plenty of time in the middle of it, myself very much included. But that's a common perception. It's a common attitude out there, Janet. You hear Bill, look, bring it on. This is what he wants. Shake it up. Change it.
Yeah, I actually have to give Trump a lot of credit. This cabinet that he's put together really includes people who seem totally right for what he's promised. You know, he said he'd get rid of Obamacare, and he made his HHS secretary, Tom Price, who's a member of Congress, who's written bills to get rid of Obamacare. He's criticized EPA, talked about practically dismantling it, and he picked somebody dedicated to dismantling it. So that there is this, you know, great consistency between a lot of the stuff, the policies that he proposed and the people that he's picking. Oh. I do think that his use of Twitter in the way he has been, you know, you got to wonder if that's going to continue into his presidency, because there is this kind of mismatch between the kind of glibness that's required in Twitter and the enormous power of the words of a president, and in this case, a president-elect. So he's kind of made his name on this medium, and it seems a little concerning that it seems unwilling to put it down when so much is at stake in every word he puts in it.
We're talking about the middle of the country and business being done there. He got some grief from a union leader in Indiana with Chuck Jones, president of the United Steelworkers 1999, represents carrier employees, who went after Trump on his claims of having saved around 1,000 jobs there. He told the Washington Post that Trump had lied his ass off. Trump went after him with insulting tweets, and then Jones was asked by CNN if he regretted his words.
No, I do not. Maybe, you know, the choice of words weren't the best, but the ultimate message was the same. He didn't tell the truth. He inflated the numbers, and I called him out on it.
Jack Beatty, people want to change. Donald Trump went to Indiana and said he brought one right there at the carrier plant. Now, the union boss there said no, the numbers weren't what the president-elect suggested, and the president-elect went straight after him by name on Twitter. This is something new in my experience, Jack.
Yes, Mr. Trump is defining the presidency down, or at least the transitional presidency, to a cyber bully. I mean, and we heard this week on Fresh Air from Megyn Kelly about her experience with Mr. Trump and his tweets. He warned her. He said, if you don't give me what I want in coverage, effectively, I will release what he calls, quote, my beautiful Twitter account on you. That was the 17 million Twitter followers he has. The president has another 12 million, so that would bring it way up. And, you know, what was his threat to Mr. Jones? He said, spend more time working and less time talking. In other words, don't criticize me. I'm the most powerful man in the world, and I can reach out through my Twitter feed to have your private life made miserable. Now, that sounds wild, but the Washington Post today has a profile of a 19-year-old college student in New Hampshire who asked Trump a question last year. She said, basically, you don't seem to be all that friendly to women or for women's rights. And he tweeted out about her. He called her the arrogant young woman was a plant from the Bush campaign. And the stream of abuse that began there, the Facebook, the Twitter, the calls, haven't stopped since. Just 5 days before the election, this young woman received this message on Facebook, wishing I could blank punch you in the face, then stomp your head on the curb and urinate in your bloody mouth. That's the sort of brown shirt fringe of the Trump movement. And to have the president of the United States singling out individuals who get under his skin in this way and then sicking his legions, because, of course, he's responsible for this, on them, on their private lives, that is a dark and dangerous development.
Audrey Cooper, Megyn Kelly said she had to have bodyguards after she tangled with Donald Trump. There's a kind of thuggish Trump following out there that can get pretty ugly in a hurry. We had Nicole Wallace, communications director for George W. Bush, top strategist to a lot of Republicans, say it's cyberbullying. It's a strategy to bully someone who dissents. That's what is dark and disturbing. This from a top Republican. On the other hand, Audrey, people want change. And here are these two things sort of floating side by side.
Yeah, there's a lot of anger in the country. I mean, to your previous caller, you know, I grew up in Kansas, and I can tell you going from San Francisco to Kansas is a pretty major difference right now. The reason I love shows like yours, Tom, and so many other ones like this is that, you know, we need to get to a place where this country can have civic discourse. And, you know, that can't happen right now while everybody's it just gets ratcheted up and ratcheted up. Everybody needs to take a breath. There are a lot of issues ahead of us: automation, immigration, what to do with the Dreamers. We need to have rational discussions about how to move forward as a country. The campaign is over. I think a lot of Americans agree it's time to start having those conversations and doing it civilly.
Can't agree more. Dale in Franklin, Tennessee. Dale, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Real quick on hypocrisy. When Melania came out and said that she was going to sort of take on the mantle for her being a first lady, cyberbullying was something that she felt was really, you know, very worthwhile paying attention to and trying to solve. When it's so outrageous that she would say that when her husband is the biggest bully of all, in my opinion, he does Twitter primarily because he's not challenged by it. I mean, he can just spew it out there. Rather than like at a press conference where people may have to actually challenge him with questions and whatnot.
You can't blame her for being opposed to cyberbullying. It's not a pretty thing, but there's certainly a tension there, Dale.
Right. Well, the other thing I wanted to say, I had a question for you guys, and that is, how long do you think it'll take for Trump supporters to come to the realization that they're not getting the change that they want? I mean, change is great if it's the right kind of change. And I see business as usual. These appointments that he's doled out this past week, it's just like every other Republican president. For the most part, they want people in there that hate the department that they're supposed to be taking care of. And why, you know, it's like, why would I want to vote for somebody who despises, national education and says, I want to get rid of the, you know, all these different offices.
Dale, we've got it. Janet Hook, do you see, these are some very conservative appointments. Okay. But is that necessarily in contradiction with Donald Trump's promises to the electorate?
I don't think so, though I do think that Dale raises a really interesting question, which is that Trump's election came with these really sky-high expectations of monumental changes in Washington. And he had some very specific things that he promised he would change, repealing Obamacare, you know, building the wall, dismantling EPA. He has a better chance of actually accomplishing those changes. And you're right that they are in some ways very traditional Republican goals. But because he has a Republican Congress now, he has a better chance of getting there. Now, his broadest and most important promise of bringing all these jobs back to the United States, that cannot be done with a stroke of a pen and just with the Republican Congress even.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, after months of protests, the Army Corps of Engineers denied a permit this week for the Dakota Access Pipeline to cross the Missouri River. Chief Avril Looking Horse celebrated with other protesters there.
People have said that, now this is either we make it or break it, and I guess we made it.
Make it or break it, and I guess we made it. Time will tell on that one. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called for a ban on full-face veils in Germany at a party conference Tuesday.
We have to show our face during personal communication, which is important. And that is why the full veil is not appropriate here. It should be forbidden, wherever that is legally possible. It does not belong to us.
Watch that. And Beyoncé grabs 9 Grammy nominations, including 3 for her single Formation off the album Lemonade. Looking at a week in the news, more Trump cabinet picks, more Trump tweets, inferno in Oakland, mistrial in North Charleston, the South Korean impeachment story, big elections, big votes in Europe this week, and John Glenn has died. Janet Hook is with us from the Wall Street Journal, Audrey Cooper from the San Francisco Chronicle. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. We've all seen the video. Does the North Charleston mistrial make sense to you? The guy running away, Walter Scott, the policeman shooting as he ran. Do you see a lasting victory for the Dakota Access Pipeline protesters? And do you remember when John Glenn came back from space a hero and everything seemed possible for America? Alyssa is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Alyssa. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to call to say thank you to all of you for discussing the lack of affordable housing in the Bay Area. My brother was one of the residents that lived there.
Is he okay?
He is fine. Physically, he is fine. Everyone that lived there is deeply, deeply disturbed by this. This was their home. Most of them had no idea that there was a party that was going to be happening. They weren't involved in that aspect of it. They lived there. And my brother, I know, said he came home and realized that there was a party going on upstairs. And, you know, they did lose one of the residents that lived there. But just the horror of that night was that will live with them forever. And I just really appreciate you guys talking about the lack of affordable housing because the residents that live there, they were pretty much all college educated. They all worked at least 40 hours a week. They had a lot of student debt that they were paying off. And I think that the fact that there was no affordable housing there, you know, it's very difficult to find any place to rent on the average salary.
Yeah.
And I'm just happy that this is coming to light, that this issue is, it's tragic that this horrible, horrible thing had to happen for this to become national news, for the lack of affordable housing to be taken seriously.
Alyssa, we're very glad that your brother survived there in that terrible fire in Oakland at the so-called Ghost Ship, this artist collective, big warehouse. Audrey Cooper, is it better understood exactly what happened and the conditions that led to the fire going so out of control? We heard about just a stack of wooden pallets as a staircase to the second floor. That sounds like a fire trap in itself.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at photos of what the Ghost Ship warehouse looked like prior to Saturday's fire, it was a tinderbox, really. I mean, there was a lot of found objects everywhere. The people, even people in our newsroom that have been there for parties or shows, said it was a really cool place if you were not looking at it from the perspective of a fire inspector who never showed up.
Yeah.
There are, you know, I think it's important, and I'm really glad that the caller's brother is okay. Almost everybody who died in the fire, the 36 people who perished, they were there to visit, to attend a show. They weren't people who were living there full time.
You got trapped.
And there is certainly an affordability question that goes into this. But there's also, there were a lot of people there who were lawyers, were not artists, who just enjoyed, you know, this sort of music. So it's affordability definitely plays into it. It's also a cultural thing of these artists, you know, feeling energized by all living together.
But we just didn't have the kind of inspection that would keep it safe for the people who were there, and they paid a very heavy price. I want to turn to the case in South Carolina, in North Charleston. Of course, this is the video that everybody saw when it came out. The judge trying the case against Officer Michael Slager declared a mistrial this week when the jury could not come to a unanimous decision. Slager, who's white, was accused of killing Walter Scott, an unarmed black man, after that traffic stop in April last year. Slager was in the North Charleston Police Department. The witness video appeared to show the moment Slager fatally shot Scott as he ran away. Here was the jury foreman, Dorsey Montgomery, telling ABC that Slager wasn't guilty of murder as defined in the law.
When we originally got the information for murder, it was immediately that wasn't something that Mr. Slater did. He did do something, but based on the law and the clauses in the law, he didn't commit murder based on what we saw, because there was nothing malicious there.
Mistrial, but it's not over. Here was Walter Scott's mother, Judy Scott, outside the courthouse on Monday.
I don't care what man say. I don't care how it looks. It's not over. Y'all hear me? It's not over. To God's sake, it's over.
Jack Beatty, we were not in the courtroom. We were not in the jury room, but it's hard to watch that video and say, flatly, this couldn't be murder. I mean, he was running away, and Officer Slager did not appear threatened, at least in what we see in the video. We know that can be misleading, but it looked awful clear.
Yes, and all this for a busted taillight.
Which is why he was pulled over in the first place.
Why he was pulled over in the first place and chased. And you know, you mentioned the jury room. This area, North Charlestown, according to what I'm reading, nearly half the population is black, yet the jurors, there are 11 whites, one African-American, and the judge has hinted that there was one lone holdout who couldn't see murder or manslaughter in that shooting in the back. And in a way, you know, it does raise the question Eugene Robinson poignantly makes in today's Washington Post: how cheap is black life in the United States of America? And he points to this case, of course, but also Eric Garner, choked to death by police in Staten Island, not charged. The officers weren't charged. Tamir Rice, no, officers shot him dead, but they faced no charges. That was the 12-year-old in Cleveland.
Yeah, we know.
Michael Brown, grand jury failed to indict the officer. These are scandals. Perhaps they're different, each one with the tone of it. But it's shocking when a video when visual right there. Evidence like that can't produce a verdict.
Well, there's the promise of more prosecution there. Another trial. I mean, we had this other incident last week. The former NFL player Joe Knight fatally shot on this road rage incident in Tarrytown, Louisiana, outside New Orleans. Police did not immediately arrest the suspected shooter, Ronald Gasser. Of course, Knight was black, Gasser was white. They waited till Monday to go and get him. Came under heavy criticism for that, but not very apologetic. At a news conference, Jefferson Parish Sheriff Newell Norman got defensive.
For those who have criticized the men and women of this organization and the strategy decisions that we made relative to that, tough. I don't care.
Tough. I don't care. Janet Hook, on the immigration front, there was talk about Dreamers this week. These are children of undocumented immigrants born in this country, raised in this country, who have been allowed to stay on, and Donald Trump had talked about ending that. Is he softening on that this week, Janet?
Well, there was a rather vague statement that he made in an interview with Time magazine where he said something that sounded like he was softening his view on it because, you know, of course, he campaigned on a promise repeatedly saying that he would on day one or in the first 100 days, revoke all of the executive orders that President Obama issued, including the ones liberalizing the treatment of Dreamers and others who are here illegally. And so in this interview, he said something like about the Dreamers, we're going to work something out that's going to make people happy and proud. Now, what he means by that, we don't know. And he has at different occasions, even on the campaign, been a little bit vague about what he was going to do rather than just deporting all people who are here illegally, the 11 million who have been here. You know, if they're not committing crimes, well, maybe he won't deport them. Who knows what it means? He did receive a visitor, an unusual visitor, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who came and delivered a letter from a dozen or so big city mayors warning him against a policy that would undercut the status of these young people who were brought who have been here illegally, the Dreamers.
Here's a little tape of Mayor Rahm Emanuel of Chicago about that letter, why he delivered it, why he and a number of other cities have proclaimed themselves sanctuary cities for immigrants.
My grandfather came to the city of Chicago as a 13-year-old 100 years ago. Chicago was a sanctuary city for my grandfather. His grandson today is the mayor of this city, which is a testament to the strength of the values and the ideals of being America.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel appealing there to Donald Trump. Let's go to Detroit, Michigan, and Aaron. Aaron, thank you very much for calling. You are on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the comment about what is black life worth in America. Let me preface it by saying that I'm a 62-year-old African American. My brother, my oldest brother, the promise of my family was slaughtered by the police in 1966 in his own home in front of his children because at that time it was just something that could be gotten away with. Of course, his wife received some minimal amount of lawsuit money or something, but it altered my family and my life in major ways. Mm-hmm. But the statement about what is black life worth in America is a statement we need to look at. Are we saying that the black life has no value? Because when Black Lives Matter started, people who commented and said all life matter, why wasn't all life mattering before someone said black life matter? Is there really still no one willing to get honest about the disparity between the value of black life or the lack of value in black life in this country? Because until we admit it, it will never change.
Aaron, I appreciate your call. That question has been raised a lot in the last couple of years. The question of how seriously it gets addressed or how deeply it gets picked up and understood stares all of us in the face. And here we are with it today. I'm going to let it stand right there, but I appreciate you making it so vivid for us. And, Jack, I'm glad you spoke to it as well. Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air, Jim.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was really excited when John Glenn decided to run for president. He seemed like the perfect candidate. And I guess my question for Jack is, what happened? You know, why couldn't a great man like this connect with the American voter?
He's pretty great whether or not he became president of the United States, don't you think, Jim?
Absolutely.
Jack?
But I still thought that he was just the perfect guy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know. Janet, let me put it first to you. John Glenn and his political career, do you have a sense of why it topped out, where it topped out? It was a pretty darn good career in the Senate, long time there, and much loved, but not the presidency.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to admit, I don't remember much about that campaign.
It's a ways
it was a while
back
ago.
Now,
it was a ways back.
Fair enough.
Actually, he was a very compelling person. And he actually, his career in the Senate spanned a long time. And one thing that was very striking, though, was how completely beloved he was in Ohio.
Yeah.
And I think he had a lot of you know, it's not always the case that when somebody comes to Congress after doing something completely non-political, mm-hmm. like being an astronaut, mm-hmm. you know, sort of a political novice comes to the Senate, and they don't always fit in. But John Glenn really found a way to do so.
He had an amazing way. Jack Beatty, when that famous flight went up and he orbited the Earth so many years ago, 1962, you were watching. You remember how that felt, how the country felt. Share with us a John Glenn sense, Jack.
Well, I think you got it, Tom, when you mentioned everything seemed possible. That was just so thrilling. Of course, it was the America trying to reach what Russia had done and surpass it.
Mm-hmm.
And with his orbital mission, that happened. You know, he was a man for hard missions. 149 combat missions in two wars. From that to he woke up Robert F. Kennedy's children and told them individually that their father had been assassinated. You know, his character was, it was a kind of national treasure. One of his biographers tells a story about him in Korea. He was leading a flight of jets to attack a bridge.
He served in the war there, yeah.
Yes, Ted Williams was one of the flying another plane, and the orders were to make one pass at this bridge, was in a river valley, and then get out of there. If you don't blow it up, that's okay, because the second time, if you tried it again, the enemy's anti-aircraft,
they're going to get you.
Yeah. So they all, I don't know how many planes there were, they flew down the valley, they dropped their bombs, the bridge still stood. And Glenn got on the radio and he said to the others, "You guys go back to the base or the carrier, I'm going to try this again." And sure enough, he tried it again. And he blew the bridge up, but the plane came back perforated with holes and there was a piece of shrapnel stuck just above his head on the headrest. He had moved his head just slightly, and he carried that for the rest of his life.
John Glenn, he put America in orbit and just had that image of a country that can do, could do everything, would do everything. Let's hang on to that. Let's do it. Jack Beatty, great to have you with us today. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Audrey Cooper, editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle. Great to have you right here with us, Audrey. Sorry about Oakland there. We'll keep it in our thoughts and prayers, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Janet Hook at the Wall Street Journal, national political reporter there. Janet, thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.